whether we're Lutheran or non-Lutheran. And what I'd like to do would be to sketch the outline of what's happened in the last 60 years and what the prospect is for the future. We heard much more about ecumenicity and the ecumenical movement 5-10 years ago than we do today, and there must be certain reasons for it. Some people feel it's come to a sort of a dead end and there's no further place to go, but I'm not sure that that is the right reading of the situation. The ecumenical movement, I think, is usually dated from about 1910, when the great Edinburgh Conference was held, which was a missionary conference. And the meaning or the significance of the ecumenical movement is closely tied in with the missionary movement. If there's any movement that is dying today, it's the missionary movement. And no one quite knows what is going to happen in the missionary movement as we've known it. Our missionaries are being excluded from some countries altogether. We're revising our missionary policy, and the question of what the missionary program of the church is a controversial one. So back in 1910, at the time when the mission had begun to be one of the prime concerns of the Christian church, Christians in the new countries, in Asia, in Africa, India, were asking, how are we going to accept all your different divisions? You send your missionaries over here from all your different American, English, European churches. We don't understand your internal dissension and the various sects and churches that you have produced. The missionaries themselves felt it was necessary to come to some kind of an understanding. And 1910 was a watershed in missionary history because it brought together so many missionaries from all over the world to discuss what the program and policies of the missionary movement should be. Some of the leaders of the church in later years were connected with that conference. It left an indelible impress upon the Christian churches. I was in Oxford in 1937 at one of the conventions that belongs in this ecumenical movement, and the leader of the ecumenical movement at that time was Archbishop William Temple, who was then Archbishop of York, later became Archbishop of Canterbury. He said that he was appalled at the Edinburgh Conference in 1910, and he rolled off a whole list of names of younger men who'd been along and gotten the vision of the missionary movement, and they became leaders in all of their churches. As some of you may have heard, John Mott and Steele and Sherwood Eddy are great names in a former generation in our own history. John Mott was along in our Augustana Convention in 1945, the last time I saw him. He was then a very old man. But between 1910 and 45, for 30 years, there was no name in the world that was better known than John Mott, especially through the YMCA movement. And the same regards to Steele and some of the other leaders that we came to know so well in America. Well, the missionary movement in 1910 asked, is it right for the churches to fight against each other on the mission field? Is it right to send money from America and Europe to congregations that are antagonistic to each other on the mission field, where one set of Christians doesn't cooperate with other Christians? And it started this movement of trying to find some new relationship between the churches. Sometimes I think we wonder that for so long a period, almost 2,000 years, Christians have just taken for granted that you shouldn't have too much to do with any other Christian. course, that's a part of our heritage. It came out of the Middle Ages with the Roman Catholic Church. It was the only church, and anyone else that was outside of the kingdom. And certainly it got to be a part of our Scandinavian heritage. I suppose a good many of us here are of Scandinavian background. And if there's any one word from my own childhood that seemed to be in second place to the devil, it would be the Pope. We were brought up to fear the Pope, to hate the Pope. The Pope represented a form of the religion that we would call Christianity. And for many of us, it's taken a long time to get this out of our blood, that anyone who isn't of our own church, we can't be a Christian. There are a lot of reasons for it, of course. We have time to discuss them here. But it did affect all of the work of the church. And until our own lifetime, this has been taken for granted, that a Christian camp here, a Christian group here, a Christian church here, and have nothing to do with each other. It led to the formation of two movements. One was life and work, and the other was faith and order. Two different paths that the churchmen thought that they could follow that would lead to a different kind of situation. Life and work was started by a Lutheran, in a sense, Nathan Soderblom, the Archbishop of Sweden. And in the First World War, 1914, Archbishop Soderblom felt that the churches should say something to the Christian nations which were murdering each other. Here you had the Christian nation of England fighting the Christian nation of Germany. All of these nations in Europe were Christian and didn't seem to affect the kind of attitude they had toward each other, to slaughter each other by the millions and bomb their cities. Soderblom said, isn't it time that the Christian church raised a voice of protest? He got together a few leaders, he issued a manifesto right in the middle of the war, asked them to come together, the leaders of the church, and see if they couldn't agree on something. Well, they couldn't get passports even from their government, so nothing came of that. But Soderblom did go ahead and organize what he called life and work, because the churches can't get together anywhere else. They can get together on certain great issues of modern life, the life and work of the church. Meanwhile, a group of the British men, churchmen, had organized Faith and Order. And they felt that the churches should come together and discuss their faith together. If we talked about what's my faith and your faith and see where we agree and disagree, can't we get a little closer to each other? And order in this connection means the way you organize the church. Some churches are Episcopal, that is, they have a bishop. Some are congregational. All of the power is in the local parish. Then you have a middle group of the Presbyterians or Lutherans, who have a national or a larger regional organization in which the local congregation sits in. Well, that is called order. So faith and order, you were to discuss the faith and the organization of the church. I ran across in our old Augustana minutes the letter from the president of faith and order, an Episcopalian, to the president of the Augustana Synod in 1914, who then was Erich Norelius. And Norelius answered this letter, and he said, "We are not now concerned, nor will we ever be concerned about such a movement." This was 1914. And for the moment, of course, that ended any part that we might have in it. Though another event, the World War, shook up everything, so that Nothing much could be done by either Faith Martyr or Life and Work until the war was over. Then around 1919 and 20, the committees got together again and they began to organize conferences. And Soderblom's leadership led to the first great conference of different types of Christians in 1600 years. For in 1925, the Stockholm Conference was held. He invited the Orthodox, he invited the Pope, hopefully he'll have nothing to do with you. He invited all of the European and American churches, and they did get a great conference together in Stockholm in 25. Stacy and some of our American Lutherans were invited and did come. In 1927, the Faith and Order movement had its first Congress in Lausanne, Switzerland, and they discussed the faith of the different churches and the matters of doctrine. That was my first experience. I was in Sweden at the time, spending a year with Scholar, and Archbishop Soderblom invited me to go along as his secretary to Lausanne, or to this barren Switzerland, preparatory to Lausanne, and gave me a chance to meet these men from different churches from all over the world. And of course, it started my interest in this movement. 1926, that's long ago, but I've never really given up my interest in it either. I didn't get to Lausanne, for which the barren meeting was preparatory, but I have followed the literature and have known many of the leaders. 1925 Stockholm, 1927 Lausanne in Switzerland. But as they went along, they got more churches and they were successful in interesting a very large part of the Protestant and the Orthodox churches. And it's very interesting that in this ecumenical movement, the Protestants for the first time, since way back in the, well, since the Reformation for that matter, got to know something about the Greek Orthodox, the Russian Orthodox. I suppose there's no subject on which we Lutherans know so little, have so little information as about the Orthodox. And I suggested that 1 hour this week we might discuss this relationship with the Orthodox, which came up this morning in the discussion. And we know so little about the Orthodox Church that I think we're apt to be super critical. I was in Moscow 10 years ago as a member of the delegation from the National Christian Council of this country. The Orthodox Church invited the delegation of 12 or 13, and I was the only Lutheran that was along. We spent 3 weeks as guests of the Orthodox in Moscow, in Leningrad, in Odessa, and I could relate a long story about those 3 weeks, which I can't now, but it has altered my whole attitude toward the Orthodox Church. I can join in any criticism that any of you make of the Orthodox Church and go even a step further. But I can also attest to the fact that there's much more life in the Orthodox Church than we are aware of. And I think it behooves us as Christians to know something about the oldest part of Christendom. The Orthodox Church is the church of the first 5-6 centuries before there was any Roman Catholic Church to speak of. Rome, of course, likes to say that he started it all. Peter came to Rome and set up the papacy, and we've been the leaders ever since. The Greeks say that's all nonsense, which of course it is. And the Greeks were the teachers of the church for the first 5 or 6 centuries. All the creeds we have are Greek, and the tradition of the church has come to us from the Greek, from the Orthodox Church, not only Greek, as the Serbian, Romanian, Bulgarian, and so forth, But these men had been willing to come along to the ecumenical council. They were in Stockholm. Soderblom was a very congenial and he had a genius for friendship. He made friends everywhere, except among certain types of Lutherans in this country. But he had a wide world relationship, and he was able to bring people together to talk together. Probably unique in modern history in that respect. And he got to the Greek Orthodox to come along to Stockholm. They came to Lausanne. I've heard some of these bearded, black clothes, high-hatted individuals preach. There's a Irenaeus that I was especially impressed by. And their preaching is entirely different. It isn't rhetorical, it isn't oratorical, but there's a certain calmness and peace about it. They have an interpretation of Christianity, which is very different from the Western interpretation. We don't know how one-sided we Christians are. We think only in terms of our own experience. But when you meet some of these men and hear them, the most beautiful church music I've ever heard, I've heard in the cathedrals of Moscow and Leningrad 10 years ago, 40 years after communism tried to kill it. There's a heritage of music in the Orthodox Church which we're entirely unaware of. And there's a devotional literature which is close to us. So if the ecumenical movement has done nothing else, it's opened the eyes of Christians to parts of the world that they never knew existed. And the Church of Christ doesn't depend on a little group here and there, as we sometimes think it does. He has resources far beyond ours. These two, Faith and Art and Life and Work, carried on their work in all the different countries of Christendom. They arranged regional conference, produced a great deal of literature, some very fine literature. And in 1937, each of them had a world conference. There was one at Oxford on life and work, and Faith and Order was in Edinburgh. It was my privilege to be along with both. I was only the first and only Lutheran from America to be along in Oxford. Others came along in Edinburgh. The feeling grew that if you're going to try to unite the church on any of these great topics, they shouldn't be working against each other. And how could you justify having two movements? And so they decided to merge these two movements. And in Oxford, 1937, they set up a committee, the committee from Edinburgh, which was all set to bring about a union of the two when the Second World War broke out. And it wasn't until 1948 that they were able to effect the organization, which became the World Council of Churches. It's a sad fact that it's taken two world wars to make the Christians think that they ought to behave as Christians toward each other. I don't know anything more ironic than this. We've got to have world wars with the bloodshed and disaster and destruction before the Christians begin to wonder, should we be united in our testimony to what kind of a world this should be in which we live? And it's after the First and Second World War that you begin to get an interest on the part of a large part of Christendom in what we call the ecumenical movement. Ecumenical is a Greek word, and ecumenicity is enough to make any sense to it. But simply the Greek word for oikoumene, which means the inhabited world. It's not only the world, the created world, but the inhabited world, mankind. The ecumenical movement is a movement for the inhabited world, for all people, including, of course, Christians. The World Council got started in 1948, and we Lutherans are grateful that we've had some very fine leadership among some Lutherans. Archbishop Soderblom died in 1930, so he wasn't along very long in the movement. But one of the great leaders became Franklin Frye. And Frye, from 1940 on, was one of the most influential voices in the World Council. He became one of the vice presidents, became the president of the Central Committee, and until his death was probably the best-known Christian in the world through the World Council. Now, I know that there's been a lot of controversy about the World Council, and there still is, for that matter, and I could be surprised if there aren't varying attitudes right here. Some of you come from churches which will have nothing to do with the World Council. You've voted not to go into the World Council. Or you have members of churches which have come into the World Council. But the great part of Christendom has joined. The argument you usually find against the World Council is, well, what you're trying to do is set up a new super church with a new pope and a super world organization which will rule all Christendom, which is absolutely untrue. When anyone tells you that, you can take for granted that they know very little about what they're talking, no matter who they are. Some of them are leaders of churches. But the ecumenical movement simply says, as Christians, we should be obligated to understand each other, sympathize with each other, know what each other believes and does, and see if we can't have something in common. There's no thought of a common organization that would be worldwide, and that fear, of course, is increased. The World Council has got a good part of Protestantism along, and then in 1960, the meeting in New Delhi, the Orthodox Church came in. The Russian Orthodox, immediately Christians threw up their hands. Ah, here the communists are coming in to dominate the World Council of Churches, and we'll all be communists. I think we should pray God to spare us from that kind of reaction. I find no justification for that kind of feeling on the part of Christians. It's not Christian. Whatever else it is, it may be natural, maybe a kind of a natural reaction to something that's strange. But I would challenge you to find anywhere in the gospel any kind of justification for the way Christians treat each other in this world. And the ecumenical movement has simply set its goal to see if there is more agreement than we know among ourselves. And the strange thing is that at the same time, while this movement's been going on, it's drawn Christians together who call themselves by the same name. The development of the Luther World Federation is just about in the same period. The Luther World Federation grew out of the First and Second World War. It's equally true that both of these were the fruit of the national catastrophe. The Commission for Soldiers and Sailors' Welfare, out of which the Luther World Federation gradually grew, was our attempt to minister to soldiers and sailors in the First World War. And after the ravages of the First World War in Germany, the homeland of the Reformation, the Lutheran churches in this country sent representatives, Morehouse and Brandel and others over there, to see what we could do to help rebuild churches which had been destroyed, clothe people. We sent packages to pastors, families which had no income. It was an attempt to rebuild after the First World War, back in the 20s. And then in the 40s, after the Second World War, we finally got together as Lutherans. Though again, it was my privilege to be at Lund in 1947 when the Lutheran World Federation was organized. And the Lutherans, large part of them of the world, decided there are things we can do together. And we find that there aren't so many differences as we believe in our faith. And here you're dealing not only with Lutherans in this country, but Lutherans in Norway, and Sweden, and Finland, and Germany, with all their divisions. It's enough to make you dizzy when you start reading Lutheran history to see in how many different groups they've been divided. Gradually, the Lutheran World Federation has brought together these Lutherans of Germany and Scandinavia, some of them, not all of them. And in this country, despite every effort that we've made, Missouri has refused to come into the Lutheran World Federation. I've been along to several meetings of the Lutheran World Federation. I've been on commissions that have met both in this country and in Europe. And we've tried time and again to write the kind of constitution which Missouri would say it could accept. And Missouri comes along to all the Federation meetings, and they call themselves unofficial observers, but they won't join. Why? Well, you explain Missouri to me, then I'll understand. their thought is that until we can agree on every minute article of faith, every point of doctrine, we can't work together. We can't even pray together. We've got to think alike on all theological terms of doctrine before we can pray even as one. Well, while to us this seems terrible, it's simply a repetition of what is true among all other groups. And the ecumenical movement has broken down many of these barriers, so that there is a different feeling today. Another great event, and here again I would like to have a whole hour to speak about this would be what's happened in the Roman Catholic Church. A veritable revolution has taken place in the Roman Catholic Church through the Vatican Council, 1961-65. What happened at Rome has affected the Church throughout the world. You probably have Catholic churches in your community where some people are leaving the Catholic Church because of Vatican Council. They don't like the changes the Vatican made. They don't like that it has a mass in English now that people can understand. There's an organization of Roman Catholics that are against any English mass. They want the Latin mass. They don't understand it, but it's more mystical, it's more liturgical, it's more impressive, and so they want it. Well, they have that same kind of thing among Protestants, too. So the Catholics are going through much of what the rest of us have gone through. But the Roman Church has changed its attitude toward Protestants. Some of the theologians in the Roman Church even suggest that some of these Reformed theologians that the Church should recall its condemnation of Luther after 400 years. And for a while it looked as if that might happen, but the Pope now is finally saying no, they can't do that. So they won't go that far. But a lot of other things have happened. And the Roman Church has begun to cooperate in some places with the Protestant Church. We have councils of churches now where the Roman priests will come along, which would be unheard of 40, 50 years ago. Yes, and in some places, of course, they won't do it yet, but it is breaking down. And Rome was invited to join the World Council of Churches. The Pope came to Geneva and talked with him there, but he too finally has decided that it isn't possible for Rome to join. And I can understand why, and there are some Christians who are glad that he doesn't, because they'd be so big that the rest of us would look small in the council. For the Roman Catholic Church is so much larger than all the Protestant churches put together. But they will cooperate with us. There are conversations going on between different church groups in Europe and in this country, between Catholics and Protestants, even between Catholics and Lutherans, which again is incredible, that you'd have a group of theologians sit down for a week at a time, or a couple of weeks, and speak with the Roman Catholics and come up with the conclusion that we aren't so different as we thought we were. And here in this country, we've been having discussions with other churches. I was a member for a couple of years that met with Lutheran theologians and Presbyterian theologians. 2-3 years we met with some of the teachers of the seminaries of the Presbyterian churches, and the report that we gave to the National Council was that there isn't enough difference between most Presbyterian churches and Lutheran churches, but we might have hope in all the fellowship. So that certainly we couldn't have thought of 50 years ago, and there are lots that can't think that way even now. That report was made several years ago, and nothing much has happened. What will happen, we don't know. But these discussions have been going on. There have been discussions in Europe, with about the same result. I would say that, in general, the frozen attitude of the churches through the centuries is breaking up. It's melting like a glacier, or like an ice field. Under the warmth, I believe, of the Holy Spirit, and that we don't know what's going to happen. I wouldn't predict what will happen. No one knows. But we can be thankful to God that these things have happened. There are certain things, I think, that will not happen. Faith and Order had a number of conventions, and in general, I think we've come to the conclusion that there's one point where we can't agree, and that's on episcopacy. The Church of England, for instance, which is a leader of a great part of Protestantism, believes that the church has to be organized as it was in the early centuries with bishops, and that the bishops carry on in the apostolic succession through the ages. And if you break up that, you break up the church. Well, they're in a minority. Most Protestants will not agree with them. But there's been no give at all on the part of the Anglican Church, or the Episcopal Church in this country, for that matter. So there isn't any fear that there's going to be any joining of these groups into one organization. And you have, on the other extreme, the Congregational and Baptist churches, which don't believe in any centralized administration. Each parish church is a law to itself. You can come together with other parishes and decide to have certain common programs, but the place of authority is a local parish. And some of the congregational leaders say that we'll never submit to any church that has a top level of officers that tell the local church what to do. As I said, the Lutherans are in between. We have parishes, congregational autonomy, but we do endure bishops and presidents for a while, and shift them around, get another group. We feel they don't hurt us too much. Meanwhile, the local parish goes on, does what it pleases, and contributes to the budget according to what it feels. Well, I don't see, therefore, any future at all for any common organization of the church. That isn't the goal. But that Christians should know each other better, know their history better, learn to find ways of cooperating with each other. Why should a dozen churches in the community have nothing to do with each other and all call themselves Christians? Well, it's even a more difficult question, why half a dozen Lutheran churches in the community and each one fighting against the other one, or saying we're better than they are, come and join our church. You see, it comes pretty close to home. And these attitudes we have towards other groupings of Christians is magnified on the world scale, so that there you have its largest form. Well, I said I wanted to let you talk. I think I've given you enough to talk about for another half hour. Do you have any questions as to the things I have tried to cover, or your reaction to some of the things I've tried to cover?
Yeah, I have a question and some comments. Last year, I went to what Bridge Seminary in the East Iowa. You know, those like the Lutheran Seminary, like that Seminary and Presbyterian Seminary, make all fit very well together. And I think that is one example of the direction ecumenism is going to take. Because there, the idea is not, you know, to fossilize anybody, but more like just to gain a better understanding of, you know, where other religions are at. You know, kind of, you know, if they have a worship together once a week. And, different styles of worship, different value systems. Makes for
it's among theological students.
Right.
Yes. And I think that by this time you have a new attitude on the part of pastors that on the whole is different from 50 or 100 years ago. I think the most extreme example I know is our own Lutheran Seminary in Chicago. As you know, the LCA seminary, there's a merger of the five seminaries that got together in the merger, and there's nothing harder to kill than a seminary, or even to move. But in the merger, we did get the five of the seminaries to give up their identity and come together in one. The seminary built a very fine building in Chicago. Meanwhile, a Catholic order had a building with Hilton, the Hilton Hotel had given them out near Aurora. Well, it proved too big for them. And so this Catholic order has been invited by the Lutheran Seminary to move into its building. And they have the same building, the Bellarmine Catholic order. And they've merged their library, they have common rooms, they do have the separate worship, they don't get together on a worship. It doesn't mean that we're united with the Catholics, but it shows how far you can go in fellowship and still maintain your identity. And it's true of many of the seminaries of the country that they form clusters. You have a cluster out of Berkeley, you have the cluster in the various parts of the country where the seminaries of the different churches agree to have things in common. So that we're beginning to find that you don't have to lose your faith because you recognize somebody else's faith. There's something in human nature that if I know something about the other man who's different from me, then I have to give up something of my faith. Well, we do have to give up something, but it needn't be my faith. It may be on bad manners, and my human nature in the attitude toward someone that is not like myself. One of the things that was discovered in the ecumenical dialogue, word that I don't like, it's an overwork, but in its original meaning, it simply means talk with each other. One of the things that emerged from these conversations all over the world among different groups of Christians was that there are non-theological factors in our church division, which simply means there are a lot of things which are not theological, and you could go on and say which are not religious, that keep us away from each other. Don't have anything to do with theology, they have a lot to do with human nature. But it isn't theological questions only. And anyone knows the history of Lutheranism in this country knows how difficult it's been for us to get over our nationalistic barriers. I grew up with the feeling that there was no better Lutheran than a Swedish Lutheran. Mm. I won't say that I changed altogether, but there were three things I learned. I grew up in New England. My father was a pastor, but I grew up in a Swedish colony. And as I look back on my earliest years, there were three things that were three assumptions. We don't realize how the assumptions, which are unspoken many times, but the basis on which we act, determine our behavior. There were three things that I sort of drank in from that community. One was to be a good child of God. You had to be Swedish. You had to be a Lutheran. You had to be an Augustana Lutheran. And it took me a lifetime to change those three things.
In my experience, it was to be a Republican.
Did I leave that out? That's right. It's Swedish, Republican, and Lutheran. Those are the three.
They're glad you lived a long time.
It wasn't Augustana Lutheran because there weren't any other Lutherans that deserved the name, by the way. So it was those three. Well, I'm hoping I'll live a little longer because I still have a few prejudices. But
you didn't mention Pope John.
Yeah.
Well, how do you feel now in that respect with his contribution?
Well, I think he was a miracle of God. Pope John was very old when he was elected, and the feeling among many of the Catholics, especially among the cardinals, was, let's select this old man. He won't make any trouble while he's got a few years left till we find someone else. This is the way they themselves say. And he turned out to be the greatest reformer in the church since Luther. He was a common fellow, a peasant, saw earthly wisdom. He wasn't flabbergasted by all the splendor of the Roman Catholic Church, set in motion things that have really split the church. Think of what's happened to married clergy or the monks and nuns and the discussions among Catholics as to meeting the modern world. John himself didn't know, of course, what the consequences would be, but he called together the bishops of the church and said, we've got to decide what the church is going to be in the world that is today. And if we get an hour this week, I'd like to discuss the documents of the Vatican, which should be required reading for every Lutheran, certainly every Lutheran pastor. Well, there's a copy in the library, I know, and it's a paperback, and it will open your eyes to what the leaders, the liberal leaders of the Church of Rome, are willing to say and do. The Pope that came afterwards has been trying to undo John's work. He doesn't like what John did, and he hasn't carried out what the Vatican Council said should be carried out. The conflict in the Church of Rome is very serious. Some of their leading theologians in Europe are writing books on, is the Pope infallible? With the suggestion that he isn't, of course. The Vatican Council said that the Pope isn't infallible. It's the Pope with the bishops, the principle of collegiality, the College of Bishops, the Pope meeting with the bishops. But the Pope doesn't want to meet with the bishops. He picks out the ones he likes and he meets with them. So they haven't been able to carry on the last 10 years that the Vatican Council started, but it is one of the religious events of our century.
I certainly hope you have accepted. We had a great time in a seminar 7 years ago. I don't really believe it. I think we encourage it. Pope John is one of my heroes. I'm glad to hear you say that.
Oh, there's no doubt about it.
May I ask another question? Since we're going to deal with the Pope later on. This principle or this practice of altar and pulpit fellowship. Now, I'm not a good enough historian to know when the terms were used first, but I recognize that on the one hand, it's an expression of each church's taking very seriously its stewardship of the means of grace, let's say the word in sacrament, and that we have a responsibility for truth, for the revelation of God through the scriptures particularly. And I remember an Episcopalian friend of mine saying that his pulpit had a Yale law kind, it had a door. And he said, I alone have the key to this lock. And no one is going to get into that pulpit. He didn't say who isn't an Episcopalian. He said who does not proclaim the gospel. Which is the term he used. So that he would not fellowship in that sense with a pastor, even in the Episcopalian sense. In the sense he had no conscience that he would teach the gospel. Now, it's always bothered me that two church bodies, let's say, that are not involved in pulpit fellowship. And therefore, we can't pray together, and we can't go to each other's tables. And that we presumably are taking God seriously and keeping the faith by this sort of practice. Just to remember, to be serious about the faith, this exclusive. So I see on the one hand, it's being manifestation of taking truth, the proclamation of the gospel, the administration of that truth. That I exclude this body. I won't have anything to do with this body because I don't believe they are taking seriously, or taking it seriously, are not proclaiming a right to the gospel and administering the sacrament. So there's a laudatory part. But it seems to me that the principle, being on one hand a good principle, becomes demonic. And that the way it's been used by the churches, and certainly in the Lutheran circles, is not pleasing to God. It must grieve him. And I remember when you and I were together on the committee with the National Lutheran Council and the jury, in anticipation of the formation of the Lutheran Council USA. And now we didn't make all the pulpit fellowship. We just got to another step, a council. But I remember when you and Franzson each wrote an essay on what is the gospel, first round that we had, referring to all the Senate 7. It is enough that we have our agreement of the gospel. And I remember after 15, 20 minutes or half an hour of discussion, there were two papers in attendance, and you wrote them in attendance, et cetera. Somebody asked the question, do the essayists agree? And you said, I agree with Franzson, and Franzson said, I agree with the gospel. And here we were, hung up. A lot of their people refusing to pray with us because the treasured principle of old and pulpit fellowship had not been cured out. Of course, I believe that faith is really it's an anomaly in the reflection of the eternal now about this whole business of taking the proclamation of the gospel or theological proposition, if you will. It's such an absolute sense that the kind of intention that from the Holy Spirit and have the church do with government.
But do you know, Dr. Now, when or how this principle of all control facilities excludes bodies of Christians from other bodies of Christians? Where is that its conception?
Well, in the United States, I do. I think it has a much older background. You're dealing here with pulpits and altars, which is the heart of the gospel and the sacrament. Who has the right to teach? Who has the right to preach? And the background of all of us Scandinavians, of course, is the state church of Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Finland, where it was the law of the land in Sweden since 1693, and going back to medieval Catholicism before then, that only those who were accredited by the church authorities, who were at the same time the state authorities, could preach. You know how Hauge was treated by the state church pastor. And many of our movements in Scandinavia, the revivalistic movements, gathered fire by the opposition of the clergy who didn't want anyone else teaching. In Sweden, you couldn't get together for a Bible class without the consent of the pastor. And you couldn't have any religious meeting unless the Prusten or Kyrkoherden gave the consent. So we Lutherans have a background of the power of the state enforcing the rules of the church as to who can teach. And of course, nobody could go to communion who hadn't received permission from the local pastor. This idea of registration for communion goes way back, where you went to the parish pastor the week previous to the Sunday of communion, and he had a little interview with you and decided whether you go to communion or not. And if he gave you permission, you could go the following Sunday. So the pulpit and altar were guaranteed in their purity, as far as the church was concerned, by the law, and that remained in Sweden until 1858, when the conventicle law was passed. For instance, the mission covenant people of our country were originally Lutherans, driven out of the church because we wouldn't allow them to have any freedom. Well, we carried some of that over into this country, and then developments here. And of course, the Missouri Synod and the other German synods had as their background this state system of the territorial governments in Germany. And in Germany, the churches that affiliate with the Missouri Synod are those that are broken with the state church. Here in this country, the Missouri Synod was able to enforce the same kind of discipline. Only the pastor taught, only the persons who belonged to the church could go to communion. But another element came in, which shows how we build up our non-theological factors. Quite early in the history of not the Missouri Synod, but even before the Missouri Synod, and groups that became a part of the Missouri Synod, they got mixed up with the Lodge question. And Missouri decided that anyone that belonged to a lodge thereby was no longer a fit member of a Christian church. And Missouri's insistence that you cannot be a lodge member goes back to over 100 years. In the early history in this country, that's something they acquired here. It got into our other synods. Hasselquist was one of our Augustana leaders. He was pastor in Galesburg. And the congregational minister in Galesburg was a man by the name of Blanchard, who later became the president of Wheaton College in Illinois, which is a very fundamentalist school. And Blanchard was dead set against all logism. And as far as I can tell, Hasselquist had got something of this from Blanchard, because it got into the Constitution of the Augustana Synod, that you couldn't belong to a lodge. They weren't quite sure how far to go, but it depended on the local pastor. I've met in later years people who say their grandfathers were excluded from the church because they belonged to the Odd Fellows, or they belonged to the Grange. But they felt that you couldn't have someone who belonged to an organization that had religious rights. You couldn't be a member of the church. And in 1875, when the General Council, to which the Augustana Synod belonged, passed a rule which is called the Galesburg Rule, Lutheran pulpits for Lutheran pastors and Lutheran altars for Lutheran members. So it goes back to 1875 when the Augustana Synod adopted it and more or less forced it on the General Council. The General Council wasn't so happy about it. That was an older group of Lutherans, especially from the East. By the way, Norwegians and Swedes were together between 1860 and 1870 in what we call the Scandinavian Augustana Synod. And I think one of the reasons the Norwegians separated from the Swedes in 1870 was that we joined the General Council, and they didn't want to join the General Council. So they formed their own synod. But Augustana did, and it exerted its influence in the council to get this Galesburg Rule. A little later, the General Council modified it by the so-called Akron Rule, which was passed at the meeting of the Council at Akron, Ohio, that the application of this rule would depend upon the local pastor, who would use his judgment as to how it was to be enforced. And gradually through the years, of course, it was more loosely enforced. But Missouri to this day has not weakened on this. You want to get the Missouri man pastor into difficulty, ask him how it comes that there are Masons in his congregation. He'll give you all kinds of answers. But they do get in somehow, though they sometimes aren't called full members. But that has been one of the points that separates us from Missouri. Always this unionism problem comes up, which is related, of course, to other synods, but the question of the lodge is one of them. And we ran into it in our merger discussions with the United Lutheran Church. That's a long story, and one of the events I will never forget, where we had a session with Franklin Fry, who didn't want that in the constitution of the LCA, which was in our Augustana constitution. We compromised so that the new constitution of the LCA doesn't forbid a member who is a Masonic member to be in the church, but it prohibits any minister from being a member. No LCA pastor has the right to be a member of the Masonic Lodge, on the theory that he's to serve all his people, and you can't make distinctions, whereas the lodge does call for favored treatment to its members. But that is in the Constitution of the LCA. Well, this Pope and Alder Fellowship then has historic roots, but it's been carried to the extreme where we Lutherans don't allow, unless there's synodical action, a pastor from another Lutheran body to preach in our pulpit, or a Lutheran. We who are not Missourians cannot go to communion in a Missouri church unless you have a very liberal pastor who's willing to break the rule of his church. But we have, outside of Missouri, come to the point that this is not our table, but the Lord's table. And it isn't for us to keep people away. At the same time, I think we shouldn't forget that this is a holy table, and we shouldn't take it too lightly. I think there is something back of this that, well, I like to quote a proverb of Henry Eyster Jacobs, who was one of my first theological teachers, and one of the wisest of all American theologians, who said, every error is a perverted truth. And in this error, there is a truth that's been perverted. At the same time as you can become very free in both admitting to your pulpit anyone who preaches and to your communion table anyone who comes, you have to remember that they should know what they're doing and that we do not thereby compromise the message that we are, as Lutherans, trying to proclaim. These aren't easy things, and it takes a good deal of wisdom and grace on the part of pastors to follow out these rules. But Pulpit and Altar Fellowship, we've tried to get a decree in the National Council. One reason that that report to which you referred didn't lead to anything is that the council itself has no authority, and it's up to the individual synods to declare Pulpit and Altar Fellowship. ALC and LCA are willing to exchange Pulpit and Altar, but neither one of them has been able to get Missouri to exchange.
I wonder if anyone can answer a question that's been in my mind for some time. Approximately 10 years ago, it may be that two comrades would remember the date exactly, the LCA leadership organized a program of Lutheran-Catholic dialogue. I was then president of Pacific Lutheran, and I was asked if I would serve as the co-chairman of the efforts in the Northwest area, especially in the area around Tacoma and down as far as Portland. And I gladly undertook that because I was deeply sympathetic. I had acquired some of my views in a difficult way, and others had come more naturally. Conrad may remember that I was chairman, for example, of the committee in its final stages, which led to the organization of the new seminary at Chicago. And I had a great deal of involvement in that program. Incidentally, there in passing, I would just wonder, maybe you'd comment on it a little later. Now that we have a Missouri Synod man as the president of that seminary, I wonder to what extent this may alter the situation. But to go back to the dialogue, we were given a set of guidelines that were sent out to us from the office in New York City, and I succeeded with one of my Catholic friends in organizing a program which we held at a very fine Catholic retreat center not too far from the city of Tacoma. And at that meeting, we did have representatives of the Missouri Synod as well. They had agreed to join us in this discussion. And in the afternoon of that first day, we had a general discussion of the religious services, the organization of the service of worship, both in the Lutheran Church and in the Catholic Mass. And a general discussion of it, so that people were free to ask questions and they were answered to the best of someone's ability. And then in the evening of that first day, we had a Lutheran service conducted with the full liturgical service in the regular order of our worship, and the Catholics attended that service. And after the service, then again we had a discussion of the meaning and the historical development of the church. The following morning, it was Catholic Mass, and the same thing took place, but a very interesting thing occurred as far as I was concerned, because late in the evening, before we went to bed, one of the Catholic priests came to me and said, would you be willing to read the gospel lesson in our Catholic Mass tomorrow morning? I said I would be not only willing, but I would be deeply deeply interested and concerned about that opportunity. And so I read the gospel lesson in the Catholic Mass the next morning, which was conducted in the English language. And I must say that it was a very moving experience, because as I looked out over the members of that audience, I saw tears streaming down the face of many people who had never in their lives thought that they would be worshiping with members of the Lutheran Church, and to have a member of the Lutheran Church actually participating in the Catholic Mass was almost unheard of. Well, we were asked to write a report of this effort which we had made. I sent in my report to New York, and I never heard another word about it. What happened to that program of Lutheran Catholic dialogue? Do you know, Conrad?
Well, it hasn't ceased. It's moved up to a higher level. Of course, when you're having these regional discussions, you're dealing with groups who, in a sense, are grassroots, but they have no authority. And your authority is somewhere up higher. Now the Catholic and Lutheran discussions are being carried on by the Lutheran World Federation. There's an institute at Strasbourg, which meets every year. And they have an executive director who has a full-time job, and they have met on quite a number of topics. And the more they discuss, the more resemblance they find between each other, which leads me to think that's the reason some people don't like these discussions. But as we discuss, we find that on fundamental things, there is an agreement that is more meaningful than some of the more superficial things. Even on such a thing as the Lord's Supper, we have found that we aren't so far apart. The point at which you can't make any progress is that the Roman Catholic Church says that only the priest ordained by the bishop who got his pall in Rome can conduct the Mass. Of course, that immediately shuts out any progress in that direction. But as to what we receive in the Mass, the body and blood of Christ, we're probably saying much the same thing, which reminds me of one of our older pastors, Pastor Seedorf in Rockford, 50 years ago told me that I'm willing to say that half of our Lutheran pastors are Roman Catholic in their interpretation of the Lord's Supper. Well, they don't know just how to tell the difference. Of course, the difference is that we Lutherans do not believe, as the Catholics do, that the words of the institution changes the host into the body or changes the wine into the blood of Christ. But apart from that, what the presence of the sacrament means in him or her who receives it, we find that there is a very great agreement. The conversations, I think, will continue, but again, I don't feel they're going to lead to any great result in our lifetime, because in the Roman Catholic Church, you can't get past the Pope. And if the Pope doesn't want a change, he has all kinds of means to keep it from changing. And the present Pope isn't too happy about some of the approaches that are made to non-Catholics. But among non-Catholics, certainly there is a new attitude. Well, even among Catholics. You say that you read the lesson of the Catholic Mass. I was pastor 10 years in Chicago. I think you're living in one of the creative periods. I think more is happening in the relationship of churches to each other today, pointing to a new direction, than it happened since the Reformation. And no one knows what the outcome will be, but God moves in mysterious ways as one would think of that.
And in 10 years, this difference has come. That's what we can't a decade has made this difference. And another decade is before. Like in Kant, we mentioned Solzhenitsyn. He has a tremendous chapter in the first circle about the, you might say, the future of the Christian church in Russia under communism. Today, the Christian church in Russia is like the socialist movement was for the last generation. And so the parents, liberal in their outlook, who sheltered and protected these people fighting for the rights and justice of the oppressed in Russia, discover their children are identifying with that hated church that they thought of as the oppressor, because now it's the persecuted minority, and they're identifying with the persecuted minority. These are the quick shifts that happen in history, and our Lord is through with us in our situation by any means. I cannot still believe that he who prays that they might be one, that the world might see, will not permit us to find a way to let that visibility show.
Now will you answer my question about the Chicago seminar?
What was the question?
Now that we have a Lutheran church,
Juries
in advance.
Yes, I'll be glad to answer that. I know Pat Wolbeck very well. And the reason he's at Chicago is he was kicked out of Missouri. Wolbeck was the executive secretary or director of the Missouri Synod until Preuss was elected. Preuss didn't fire him, but he abolished the office. And here was Wolbeck without a job, and a very competent, so competent, Augustana gave him an honorary degree before he got kicked out, and I think that's something to do with his being elected to Chicago.
I worked with him for many years in various committees, and so I know him very well. But I didn't know that. Has he membership?
He's a member of one of our churches.
This is what I didn't know.
Yeah, both he and his wife. No, they've seemed to be very happy there. And I heard today that one of the men that was on our conversation with the National Lutheran Council with Missouri prior to the formation of the new council, Bauman, is now a teacher at Columbus.
That's right. Well,
and I wonder where Franzman came out of Wisconsin, and I don't know where he'll go. But it's a question where all these men who are going to be fired out of St. Louis are going to go. What is it, 50, 60 of them?
40 out of 45. I've already asked their leader to be here next summer, so you'll have a chance to hear him, because Rich Kamer asked me to ask his dad.
Maybe you know what is going to happen to people like Martin Marty with respect to their relationship to the church.
Well, I went over this a long time ago with both him and with, of course, someone who even posted me for a long while, and that's our friend now at Yale.
Pelican?
Pelican Jerry. Because, of course, he left, and I scolded him for leaving Missouri Seminary because he was having a member of the Presidium in the class all the time, checking up and everything he said. He got weary of it. But they relate. I mean, their prestige and their audience we have given to them. I mean, the non-Missouri Synod Lutheran in America have given Marty his lead region, his audience, as well as Jerry. They know this. And then they went over to join Chicago. He had a position on the Chicago faculty, that is, on the University of Chicago faculty, and with the Christian Century. And he plays rather fast and loose with this relationship to Missouri. They have long ago given up on making an impact felt, and I had told them because I felt that even if my synod didn't want me, just staying and being around made them have to take me. And if they stayed with Missouri, we could hope for change. I think one reason why New Orleans could happen is that this type of man has left them, and they haven't listened to them since they've left. And we haven't been able to get into their laymen with adequate strength to this particular place to make enough difference like we could with the American Church of San Antonio. And that's the way we analyze it, as we talk about it. The
And when the church does this way, how can the world expect that we're going to reform the world?
Would it help if we started with the little folks in the Arctic Harbor area? That the church has had their summer school, Bible school, in the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't talked to any of the people who were active in it to see how it worked or what the results were, but they have done that over there. And whether they keep their teaching separate, but anyway, the children are all together and in the same school.
We do have examples of summer vacation schools where Catholics have cooperated.
Yes. Well, wouldn't that to get it to the little folks without
if you
that
get
idea
the priest,
of division?
You have to get the priest to give his agreement.
Yes.
And that depends on the bishop. And bishops depend on who's above them. So a lot
if
of things can happen.
In areas, each you have a nucleus here and there.
I think it's a wonderful beginning at the grassroots, very grassroots. Yeah.
And something else very revolutionary is happening in the Catholic Church. They're losing faith in their own parochial schools.
Yeah.
Conduct services every night, and they move from church to church, Catholic to Protestant, and they preach in many churches at that point. And in that town, as of this year now, all the parochial schools, and they had it from the kindergarten to high school, are wiped out, and the school system has to assume the responsibilities. So they are buying the buildings of the Catholic Church, school buildings. So that in my son's congregation's case, their neighbor had only a school building, and then he used the gymnasium for the church. And of course, the school system has now bought that, and the Catholic Church is using our church, my son's congregation's church. During the time that they build a new church, and which is going to be right next door to the share.
Well, it's a new era. Our time, I guess, is up. There's another subject I didn't touch on, which has also come in under this ecumenical movement. That deserves a discussion of its own. And that's the relationship of the Christian to the Jew.
Let's take an hour on that, because we've discussed it in the Lifebound Richmond. That's a very rich one. It's a wonderful one because the literature is there for you to read in terms of novels and so on, too.
There's been a veritable revolution in that respect. Well, thank you.
I'd like to hear from people. If you'd like to have two guards and let this movement